college, go to war, or what would happen next for America. It's amazing how easy it was to lose that feeling of safety.
College.
Michael Seja, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. I tried to focus on rehashing the reading I had done the night before for my ethics and journalism quiz. As I walked in the door and quickly took my seat, I realized the quiz wasn't going to happen. The professor had both TVs in each corner of the classroom tuned to two different channels, each reporting on that World Trade Center crash. "Just keep watching," our professor said. "Today's lesson just changed."
Mallory Cara, New York University. A long line of people waited for an actual payphone while trying to use their cell phones. The internet on all of the NYU library computers was painfully slow. After 10 minutes of pressing refresh, I read a 3-lined AP story to my friend Gia aloud. "Two planes have crashed into World Trade Center." It took me a second to even realize what those words even meant. In this pre-Twitter world, I finally summed up my feelings in my live journal at 9:14 a.m., OMG, I am so scared.
Daphne Lee, Ripping College, Wisconsin. I called my friend Andy over in the freshman boys' dorm. He very sleepily answered. In the calmest voice possible, I told him to turn on the TV and call me back. As we watched, it happened again. A plane flew into the second tower. Almost immediately, my phone rang. It was Andy, calling to tell me he saw it and that he was signing up. I was stunned, at first not even knowing what he meant. He kept talking, telling me that he had to call his mom and that he'd stay and finish freshman year, but he was signing up because that's what you do. Andy did sign up. He joined the National Guard that year.
Natasha Wright, George Washington University, D.C. I will never forget how surreal it was returning to the dorm and turning the TVs on. Finding out the Pentagon had been hit, watching residents of the Watergate across the street from us be evacuated as we were on lockdown and couldn't leave. The panic began to spread. Students on my floor cried together. Some residents packed bags to walk across the bridge and out of the city. Most of us sat in shock. I cried. A lot. We barely knew one another, and we were instantly bonded.
Daphne Lee. I contacted friends from home via our only means at the time, AOL Instant Messenger, as we were scattered around the country. We all shared the same fears.
Ernie Smith, Michigan State University. It was my first real time living away from home. I had only moved in 2 weeks prior. When those two towers were hit, there it was. My first real memory of being on my own.
Michael Seja. That was the first moment since I arrived at college where I felt like I needed my mom and dad, and they weren't there.
Courtney Kirkpatrick, University of Texas. Suddenly, being out in the world felt exhausting.
We didn't know who was friend or foe. At Offutt Air Force Base. At 2:50 p.m. Eastern Time, 1:50 p.m. local time, Air Force One landed at Offutt Air Force Base, outside Omaha, Nebraska.
Admiral Richard Meese, Commander, U.S. Strategic Command, STRATCOM, Offutt Air Force Base. We didn't know that he was coming to Offutt until about 15 minutes before. There wasn't much communication with Air Force One at all. There wasn't going to be any pomp and circumstance. I had my driver and a Secret Service agent, and the three of us went out to the runway to greet Air Force One in my plane Chrysler.
Sergeant Chad Heithoff, maintenance unit, Offutt Air Force Base. They announced a ramp freeze, meaning no one could move on the ground, and the next thing I knew, there were security forces everywhere. Full flak jackets, M-16s. We could see Air Force One coming in, with two fighters escorting it. It was chilling and scary.
Staff Sergeant William Buzz Buzinski. Landing at Offutt was probably the one funny moment of the day. I'm a big guy, 6'4", 270, but Will Chandler's also a huge guy. He's 6'3", 250. We always said he's got hands the size of a TV screen. Well, we were the first two off the plane. The rear stairs are always down first. You get off and guide the front stairs in. When we got off, underneath the jet were 5 or 6 maintainers who were trying to plug the plane into ground power. No one told us they'd be there. All we saw were this group of 5 guys. Chandler yelled, "Clear the area!" He just let out this bellow. Well, it was like cat scattering. They dropped radios, dropped the cable. They were panicked. There's this big guy coming at them. It was hysterical. I laughed.
Richard Balfour, Security, Air Force One. We didn't know who was friend or foe, even on the bases. We kept everybody at arm's length away from the aircraft.
Dave Wilkinson. By the time we got to Stratcom, there were like 15 to 20 planes still unaccounted for nationwide. People will say it was only 6, but there were a lot more than that. For everything we knew, they were all hijacked. But even as we landed, they started to kick them off quickly.
Admiral Richard Meese, I decided to bring the president down into the command center via the fire escape entrance. That was the most expedient option. I'd never used it before. It was there for emergencies. I had them open it from the inside.
Brian Montgomery, Director of Advance, White House. There were a lot of airmen in battle gear lining the route to the bunker. We pulled up to this 5-story office building, and instead of walking in the front door, the admiral said, "No, we're going in there." We headed into this concrete building, just a door. We went down and down and down, pretty far underground.
Ellen Eckert. When he went into the bunker, wow. That's still a scene in the movie in my head all these years later. Clearly, the only way to go was down. We stood outside, waiting. We smoked a million cigarettes. All my new chain-smoking friends.
Eric Draper. I finally had a chance to call my wife. I said, "Honey, I'm going to be home a little late tonight." I could hear her laugh through the phone, even as she was crying. She said, "I saw you with the president, so I knew you were okay."
Admiral Richard Meese. We went directly into the command center. That really caught the president's attention. All these soldiers, they're all in battle dress. CNN was prominently displayed. A lot of footage of the 2 towers. We had 4 to 6 TV screens all energized. I sat him down where I normally sit and walked him through what he was seeing, so he had an awareness.
Andy Card, Chief of Staff, White House. It was right out of a TV movie set. All these flat-screen TVs, all these military people, you could hear the fog of war. All these communications from the FAA and the military. But it was tough for the military folks. They all wanted to stand and show respect to the commander-in-chief, but you could tell they wanted to sit and do their jobs. Everyone was schizophrenic, half sitting, half standing. Everyone was moving around. After a few minutes, the president turned to me. "I want to get out of here. I'm making it hard for these people to do their job."
Major Scott Hooter Krog. All the rules that fighter pilots spend their lives living by were now out the window. When we landed off it, we got more gas and picked up maps for the rest of the country. There are always maps and approaches for the country and base operations, but all the maps always said, "Do not remove from base operations." We took all of them and stuffed them in our bag. Colonel Tillman walked into base operations, and we finally started to get some information. The president was actually an alumnus of our unit in Houston, and Colonel Tillman told us he feels comfortable with you guys and wants you to continue with us. We told him we'd sit back about 5 miles. You don't get that close to something that valuable for all sorts of reasons, but if something happened, we can eat up that range real quick.
Admiral Richard Meese. The VTC video teleconference was the 3 of us, the operator, and his military aide. There was no real audience. We listened as everyone reported in. Richard Clark of the National Security Council, Transportation Secretary Norm Mineta, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, National Security Advisor Condi Rice, CIA Director George Tenet. Most of the initial conversation in the VTC was focused on who did this. There was a lot of speculation. It was too early to make definitive. Then we were talking about how do we restore some sense of normalcy quickly, both for New York and for the country. And then How does the president get back to Washington?
Colonel Matthew Klimo. At 3:15, there was a teleconference with President Bush. The president was firm and in control, and I felt inspired. I remember very well his exact words as he started the teleconference. He said, "I want everybody who's listening to this SVT, which means secure video teleconference, to know that no faceless thugs are going to hold this country at bay."
Norman Mineta, Secretary of Transportation. He said, "We're going to find out who did this. We're going to seek them out, and we're going to destroy them."
Colonel Matthew Klimo. Someone spoke up, and I don't know who, and they used profanity. President Bush said, "Look, first thing, get the facts straight. Second, clean up your language." And my reaction was just what yours was. Everybody chuckled.
Josh Bolton, Deputy Chief of Staff, White House. The whole tenor of the presidency changed immediately at that moment. Mike Morrell, Presidential Briefer, Central Intelligence Agency. When Tenet explained that he had evidence pointing to Al-Qaeda, the president turned around and looked at me. His look clearly said, "What the fuck happened here? You were supposed to tell me first." I tried to explain with my look that I was sorry. I didn't know how my message had gotten lost. I went to a nearby office and called Tenet's assistant, angry. I felt like I'd let the president down.
Andy Card. We all suspected that it was Al-Qaeda. I'd thought that since the classroom door. It wasn't that dramatic of a moment, actually. Think of what would have happened if he'd told us that it was Russia, China, or another nation state, or an American splinter group.
Major General Larry Arnold. We had just about everybody on the ground, but we were concerned about one aircraft. It was a U.S. air flight that had taken off from Madrid and was going to JFK. It was the last aircraft that had been called potentially hijacked. The phone rang from Bob Marr, and he said, "We just got word from U.S. Air that that airplane turned around." I picked up the phone from my executive officer, and I heard the president again talking to the Secretary of Defense. I interrupted and said, "Mr. President, the last airplane has landed. Everything is down that we can see." He did not question it. It was just, "I'm going back to Washington."
Julie Ziegenhorn, Public Affairs Officer, Offutt Air Force Base. We were working at our desks, and all of a sudden, there was the president striding down the hallway. He walked right out the front door, waving to us. He shouted, "Thanks for all you're doing."
Gordon Jandro. We were there with the press pool, and our Secret Service agent said, "Oh my gosh, we've got to go right now. The president's leaving." Ann Compton was on with Peter Jennings. I didn't want to panic her or the nation by making it seem like we were leaving abruptly, but we needed to leave. I mouthed, "We have to go." She was on the radio and she said, "I'm told we're leaving. I don't know where we're going." Peter Jennings said, "Godspeed, Annie."
Colonel Mark Tillman, Presidential Pilot, Air Force One. We thought he was going to be there for a while. I was sitting in base operations planning for the ride home when someone came in and yelled, "I think the president's headed back to the plane." I told him no, he said he was going to be for a while. They told me no, I just saw him drive by. I started to race back to the plane. He'd already gotten there. He's waiting at the top of the stairs. He did his classic move and tapped me in the chest and said, "Tillman, let's get home."
Major Scott Krog. No one told us that Air Force One was leaving, so we were like, "Oh shit, are they starting up?" We're racing to get our planes in the air, but it takes some time. We met the minimum safety requirements and hit the air. A 747 configured like that, gosh, that's a fast airplane. We didn't want to go supersonic, it'd burn up too much fuel. So we talked to them, and we had to reel them in.
With the president's orders and mindset clear, but the president himself still hours away from Washington, aides back at the White House moved ahead with briefing the press about the state of the nation's response.
Nick Callio. We had a long discussion about what we should be doing, whether we should all be going out and be seen publicly. We decided to do a briefing. There was a discussion, Mary Madeline was there, Scooter Libby, about whether we should go out in force and say, "Here's the White House staff, we're out, it's safe." Our intent was to send a reassuring message. In the end, we just sent Karen Hughes.
Karen Hughes. The Secret Service thought the White House press room was still not safe, so they took me, surrounded by agents with their weapons drawn, to the nearby FBI headquarters. I remember feeling vulnerable. We didn't know who the enemy was or where they might be lurking. My colleague, Mary Matlin, counselor to Vice President Cheney, came with me. I remember being grateful to have a friend by my side. I read from a prepared statement I had typed myself. The text was faded and barely legible in places. The printer in the emergency center had been low on ink. I'm Karen Hughes, counselor to President Bush, and I'm here to update you on the activities of the federal government in response to this morning's attacks on our country.
Profound quiet. Afternoon in America. As the morning of September 11th passed, a stunned, wounded nation found itself enveloped in quiet. Businesses and schools closed. Traffic thinned. The normal air traffic overhead fell silent. Many Americans, both ordinary civilians and government officials, were glued to the television, soaking in the news, overcome with emotion.
Gabriela Daya Dominguez, resident, Chatham, New Jersey. My husband worked in the South Tower, and I was about 7 months pregnant. I tried to call my husband. I was rather frantic. I tried to call and call. I couldn't reach him. There was no answer. I spent several hours just pacing my floor. He finally did make his way back on the ferry, and our son's classmate's father gave him a ride home. He pulled up in a car I didn't know. I ran out to greet him, and I was amazed because his shirt was white. By this time, clothes were all sooty and stuff because the towers had already collapsed. I remember my first thought was, his shirt is clean. And then I ran into his arms, crying. Susanna Harada, resident, Arlington, Virginia. My son was born that day in Arlington Hospital at 1:40 in the afternoon. The first plane hit, and then the second, and then the Pentagon. And then my doctor said I needed a C-section. For the longest time, I wondered if he gave me the C-section because they were expecting so many injured from the Pentagon, and they needed to get my delivery over with. I said, "Look, the TV has got to go off. You guys have to focus on me. My doctor and my husband are watching TV, so the TV got turned off. It was a hard time to have a baby. You're supposed to be so happy. And you're not. Every mother has to struggle with that, but then the thought, what world is this? We weren't sure what was going to happen next.
Linda Carpenter, kindergarten teacher, Philadelphia. Although the sky was still the same beautiful blue that promised a perfect day on my drive to work, the sky now seemed eerily empty. Quiet, but not peaceful. I kept an eye on the sky on that drive home, fearful of the outdoors.
Wilson Surratt, executive producer, WPIX-TV, New York. A melancholy silence crept in. For the next few hours, we worked in a low hum of conversation and deep breaths. We struggled to hold it together.
Thomas Rogers, attorney, Cambria County, Pennsylvania. I remember looking up in the sky to see if I could see any plane. It seemed like everything was so still and quiet when you did that because there was nothing, no noise. We get used to the noise of the planes going over us. All at once, you notice the silence.
Teresa Flynn, the profound, profound quiet.
Specialist Ben Bell, Sentinel, Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, U.S. Army. The thing I remember was the flight pattern in D.C., it comes over the Potomac from the east and drops into Reagan. It's a loud part of tomb guarding. You always heard the planes coming in. It's the only thing that disrupts the sanctity of the tomb sometimes when you're out there. That silence. There were no people. There was nothing going on. The eerie silence. To hear that during the middle of the day, that was really eerie. Not to have any sound, like the dead of night.
Preston Stone, resident, North Dakota. I lived about 2 miles from the Fargo airport, and the silence from grounded planes was striking and haunting. Nate Jones, freshman, Wheaton College, Illinois. I was 1,500 miles away from all of this, and I didn't feel safe. I remember looking at the sky in the afternoon and seeing no contrails, no jets anywhere. It was blue and empty and silent. I still can't look at blue sky the same way.
Charity C. Tran, student, University of Southern California, Los Angeles. I remember the silence of the sky. The deceptive peace of a clear blue sky, empty of its white specks of flying planes. Anne-Marie Reedy Borenstein, Maryland. The world seemed to have stopped. It was almost as if everyone was holding their breath, waiting for what would happen next.
Teresa Flynn, you don't know how quiet a place can be. There was nothing on 395. There was nothing on George Mason Drive. The one thing that was interesting is that every single house in the whole block, by the time the sun set, the people were home, and there was that blue light coming out of their windows with every single person watching TV.
Dina Burnett, wife of United Flight 93 passenger Tom Burnett. All I wanted to do was go to church. I knew my children were fine. The principal called to let me know the kids were okay, and they did not know about the airplane yet. Several parents were picking up their children from school that day, but I decided to let mine stay. Being there was better than being at home and seeing me fall apart. I needed some time to decide how to handle the emotions. So I went to church.
There's so much luck involved. Searching. Family members, co-workers, colleagues fretted and feared the losses at the World Trade Center as the day's staggering toll mounted. Survivors, for their part, realized how big a role happenstance played in who emerged from the morning's carnage. The search for the missing proceeded desperately, both at hospitals and at the acres of destruction that would come to be known as Ground Zero.
Mika Brzezinski, correspondent, CBS News. There was a worse moment for me. We brought in a security guard from the World Financial Center. As he was waiting to go on air, the guard told me he had seen a WABC TV van crushed in the collapse. My husband, at the time, Jim Hoffer, worked for WABC. I began to get a little panicked that I had possibly lost my husband. I remember being two people. One person doing her story, the other totally numb, wondering, where the hell is my husband? What am I going to do if I lose him? Right after my report, the producer got in my ear and said, Mika, your husband's fine. I cried. I felt so lucky.
John Napolitano, father of FDNY firefighter John P. Napolitano. I thought, I've got to call my friend Lenny Creasy. I have to tell him what's going on. His brother, John Creasy, a lieutenant in hazmat, was like an uncle to my son. I called Lenny's house and his wife, Millie, answered the phone. And she was crying. I said, Millie, is John missing? She said, yes. I said, so's my son. Lenny and I went to a Brooklyn precinct, and they bent every rule in the book to get us over the bridge. We went and parked near Rescue 1 downtown. We saw guys from hazmat. Lenny and I went up to them and asked about John Creasy if they knew anything about Rescue 2 and the guys. They said, no, nothing. Nothing, nothing.
Susan Baer, General Manager, Newark International Airport. One of the things that someone started doing early on was keeping a list of everyone we'd heard from, which made people feel better, on a blackboard in the conference room. Everybody could see it. So if someone said, I heard from so-and-so, she didn't go to work today, or she was out at LaGuardia today, we'd write that name down. That day was fraught with that very raw emotion about who survived and who hadn't. Sonny Mindell. At some point, we announced where the victims' families should go. The Armory. The Armory was turned into the victim focal point, where they should gather. We headed over there as well. There were lines around the block, people clamoring for information. It was a warm day. People were out on the street. They were hot. They were frightened. They were heartbroken.
Kimberly Archie, resident, California. My brother was a pilot for United at the time. He normally flew flights 92 and 93. His wife had surgery on September 10th, so he was not the co-pilot that day. But I will never forget seeing the news and how I froze for what felt like hours in shock, thinking my brother was on that plane. Even when I realized he couldn't be, it was so hard after that to not feel for the families of the victims as if it were us.
Linda Crooner, your survival was such a big degree of luck. There are so many points of luck that make you realize how random life is. People say, oh, you were so smart to leave. Who knows? The way it turned out, I was smart to leave, but I would have been smarter taking the elevator. There's so much luck involved in this, in who lived and who died.
Mark DeMarco, Officer Emergency Service Unit, Truck 1, NYPD. Why did we get out? In the beginning, I had this guilty feeling. If I had made a right instead of a left, if I had been 5 minutes or 2 minutes slower, if I had gone to a different team. There were so many variables. Everybody who was there says the same thing. It was luck. Nothing more than luck.
Stephen Blyhar. It was a day of lefts and rights.
Norma Hardy, Officer, PATH Command, PAPD. As it got later into the night, then you realized that a lot of our guys were still missing or unaccounted for. We started talking amongst ourselves, the Port Authority police. Where did you last see this one? Who went this way? Who went that way? We started to realize that they were in a lot of trouble.
Detective David Brink. Out of the emergency service response from the NYPD that morning, 50% were lost. We lost 14 of the 23 guys.
Bill Spade. My brother-in-law, who was in Rescue 5, called me up and he said, Bill, everybody's missing. I said, what do you mean everybody? I named every guy I had breakfast with that morning. I kept naming names, Mike and this guy and that guy. He said, no, Bill, they're all missing. Then my wife called me later that evening also. She said, did you get the bad news? I said, yeah, everybody's missing. She said, no, your uncle was on flight 93. I remember I said, all right. I said, give me all the bad news now you want. This is the worst day of my life.
At 5:20 p.m., the 48-story building known as 7 World Trade Center, which had been burning furiously after being struck by the wreckage and debris from the adjacent Twin Towers, collapsed into itself. Overwhelmed by its losses, the magnitude of the day's tragedy, and the lack of water pressure in Lower Manhattan following the Twin Towers collapse, the New York Fire Department had decided to let the building burn.
Jeff Johnson. My eyes were really in bad shape. I had taken a piece of cardboard and cut a slit in it so I could put it over my eyes to cut down on the amount of light. We got to Stuyvesant High School, and they had a triage center set up inside. They gave me water and flushed out my eyes. I got up to go back out onto West Street, and as I was stepping down the stairs out to exit the high school, people were running again. I couldn't figure out what the heck was going on. A huge plume of smoke came up West Street. Building 7 had collapsed.
Detective David Brink. I couldn't believe it. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. How many more buildings are going to fall?
Dan Nigro, Chief of Operations, FDNY. It would have been the largest collapse in the history of firefighting of a high-rise building if it had not been for WTC 1 and 2. We had another 48-story building came down in a matter of seconds, but thankfully not one additional person was injured when that building came down.
William Jimeno. We heard a huge explosion, which sounded like the same thing that happened the first two times, but it was further away. We believe this was Building 7 coming down.
Scott Strauss. Building 7 comes down about 5:30. and they take the organized rescue effort off the pile. Hey, guys, we're getting off. The buildings are coming down everywhere. Let's get off the pile. Let's regroup. It wasn't a pile until days later. We called it the Trade Center. And then the terminology evolved into the pile. And then it became Ground Zero.
Jeff Johnson. At that point, I lost it. I broke down. A friend of mine, Eddie Callahan, saw me. He said he thought I was dead. There were a couple of these Chevy Suburbans, chief cars. Eddie had one, and he goes, "We're getting you out of here." They put a bunch of guys, as many guys as they could fit, into the rig that had been pretty beaten up. It was funny. We tried putting the air conditioning on to cool us off. It was blowing so much dust we couldn't see to drive. We had to open the windows to let the dust out. He brought me back to my firehouse.
At Ground Zero, an impromptu bucket brigade had begun work, trying to sift through the acres of burning wreckage in hopes of finding survivors and recovering the dead. The fires at Ground Zero would burn for another 99 days until they were finally extinguished for good on December 19th.
Paul McFadden, Firefighter Rescue 2, FDNY. The rubble, the field was so large that you're saying, where could you actually start?
Omar Olayan, Officer, NYPD. Once you got to the top of the rubble pile, there was all this smoke, and the buildings on the side were on fire. At some point, you would get smoke inhalation, and your eyes were burning out of your head, and you couldn't do it anymore. So you would go over to One Liberty, the building. They would nebulize you a little bit, wash your eyes out a little, and then you'd get back on the line and do it again. They had little paper masks, but at some point we took them off because they would get black in about 2 minutes, and it was worthless.
John Napolitano. When we came onto West Street and saw the debris field, I didn't even know that was a street. It was steel all over the place and smoke rising, and it was chaos. It was a movie set that some deranged director thought of. It was the most horrific thing that I ever saw in my life. Where do we start? Where do we begin? I saw the lines of rescue workers moving debris, a bucket at a time. Lenny went over to the wall and he started to write, "John Creasy, call home," on the ash. I was getting so overwhelmed, saying to myself, "Yeah, I want to believe my son's here. I want to believe he's alive, but it don't look good." I walked over to the wall, and with my finger, I wrote a big message in the ash. I wrote, "Rescue 2, John Napolitano, I'm here and I love you, Dad."
Denise McFadden, wife of FDNY firefighter Paul McFadden. Paul called, and he was up on the pile. I didn't understand what he was saying because he was naming name after name that we knew, then saying, "Dead." I said, "Stop it. What are you doing?" I said, "Is this some sick joke?" He couldn't stop. He kept rattling off name and dead. He couldn't say anything else.
Captain J. Jonas. I'm sitting at the ambulance, still with Tommy Falco, and he looks at me and he says, "Hey, Cap." He says, "How many guys do you think we lost here today?" I look out across the field and I says, "Oh, man, I don't know. Maybe a couple hundred." I caught myself when I said it. I said, "What the heck did I say, a couple hundred?" Prior to that day, our biggest life lost fire we had was 12. And I'm saying a couple hundred. As it turns out, I was off by almost a half. The numbers are staggering.
John Napolitano. At one point, I joined the bucket brigade and I was moving the dirt. They would give me the buckets. I remember somebody saying, "This is a piece of the plane. You've got to give it to a Fed." The guy pointed at me because I was in civilian clothes and I had dress pants on. They gave me this piece of metal, thin metal, and I was holding it. I walked off the mound and I looked at a guy, and he does look like a Fed.
I went up to him and I said, listen, they said, give this to a fed, I said. They gave it to me, but I'm an ex-cop, not a fed, I said. Are you a fed? He nodded his head, and he stood there watching everybody and everything, and he took it.
Paul McFadden, when everything settled, I lost 46 friends. They were either my friends or they were sons of my friends.
Captain Jay Jonas, from the time we walked into that building till the time we got out late that afternoon, the world changed. By the time I saw sunlight again, the world was completely different. When we were trapped, we couldn't fathom what it looked like outside. It was beyond our wildest imagination how bad it truly was.
How drastically the world had changed. 9/11 at sea. Far from America's shores on September 11th, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise, CVN-65, was beginning its return voyage from an April deployment to the Persian Gulf. But as TV broadcasts brought word of the attacks at home, the ship changed course.
Captain James Sandy Winnefeld Jr., Commander, USS Enterprise. There had been a lot of noise on the intelligence nets over the summer. Some terrorist plot going on out there. We didn't know what it was, but we thought it could very easily be targeting our high-profile ship. We took exceptional precautions on our Suez Canal transit from the Mediterranean into the Red Sea because we were just worried. Obviously, nothing happened, so we entered the Persian Gulf and spent 3 months there supporting operations in Iraq. This was enforcing the no-fly zone in Iraq, Operation Southern Watch. We had just finished an extremely successful strike against an Iraqi surface-to-air missile battery, and we were finished with the operational part of our deployment and had exited the Arabian Gulf on our way to a port visit in South Africa on the way home. On the afternoon of 9/11, the morning back on the East Coast, I was in my sea cabin reading and got a phone call from my safety officer to turn on the TV. He said, "There's something going on in New York." It was only a minute or so after I turned the TV on that I watched the airplane hit the second tower. Right there, it seemed pretty clear to me that we weren't going home. We weren't going anywhere because there was a good chance this attack originated from somewhere in Afghanistan. We knew all about Al-Qaeda. It was hard to describe the feeling of the Pentagon being hit, wondering if any of my friends were a victim of that attack. Wondering exactly how bad the damage was because it was hard to tell from the TV. And then this feeling that they struck right at the center of who the military is, who we are, what we believe, how we try to defend our country. Watching those two World Trade Center towers come down, that was probably the most shocking thing I've ever seen. That was like, oh my God, the world has changed. Everybody on board was really angry, really shocked. But we knew we would probably be a part of the answer. Over the course of the afternoon, we had a number of meetings. Ultimately, the decision was mutually made that we would turn north toward Afghanistan. Our goal was to be off the coast by the very next morning, ready to conduct strike operations if we were asked to do so. When I announced the change of course, I told the crew something like, "I know none of you are disappointed. Our port visit to South Africa has been canceled. We're out here on the front lines, and there's every possibility that sooner rather than later we'll be asked to answer for this heinous act that's been committed against our country." You can imagine how helpless we felt at sea watching this all unfold on TV. Everybody was worried about what the terrorists were going to do next. It was the first time in my life that I felt safer at sea than my family was at home.
Weeks later, the USS Enterprise would launch the first U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan. Word of the attacks continued to spread throughout that Tuesday, finally reaching the U.S. Navy's fast attack submarine USS Norfolk SSN-714 at dinner time, when the stealthy submarine came to the surface to collect the day's news.
Matt Dooley, crewman, USS Norfolk. We were at sea the week of September 11, 2001 for routine operations and training. When we left Norfolk Naval Station in Norfolk, Virginia, there were fishing boats and pleasure craft in the bay, and it seemed like a quiet day to be on the water. We cleared our communications broadcast early that morning and submerged for our daily tasking. When a submarine is underwater, it is out of communication with the outside world, and therefore is required to clear communications broadcasts every 12 hours or so. When we cleared our broadcast the evening of September 11th, we quickly learned how drastically the world had changed in the 12 hours since our morning broadcast. A sailor that worked in our communications room interrupted our captain as he was eating dinner and told him he was needed in the communications room. Moments later, the captain addressed the crew and read the initial reports over the ship's intercom system. I remember his first words, and they still echo in my ears. The United States has been attacked. We thought this had to be some type of government or military exercise. It all sounded like something from a movie. Since we couldn't see images of the news, we only had the images playing in our heads. We stayed at periscope depth, just below the surface of the water, where our antennas could come up and download communications for the next few days to get information as it became available. None of us knew what we might be asked to do. It was about a week before we were allowed to come home, and we got to see the images of the attacks for the first time. For a week, we only had text on paper, and each of us in the submarine hoped it wasn't real. Finally, seeing the footage for the first time is a feeling none of us can forget.
We still continue to fight this war. Afternoon at the Pentagon. By late afternoon, the scene at the Pentagon had settled down. Across northern Virginia and Washington, injured personnel sought treatment. Rescuers and firefighters settled in for a long siege at the crash site.
Captain Gary Tobias, Arlington County Fire Department. They took a load of us on a bus down to the Pentagon to start relieving the people there who had been there all day.
Chuck Cake, firefighter and EMT, Arlington County Fire Department. Long about 4:30, the call came through that anybody that hadn't been to the Pentagon yet, get on the bus, you're going, it's your turn. I was sent to the interior. We were deployed to the C-Ring to look for survivors and to take care of spot fires. There was wreckage everywhere, and little spot fires all over the place, except there were bodies thrown in with it too. There were still many, many victims in the building, most of them uniformed. That particular office must have been Air Force because I saw a lot of Air Force uniforms. A lot of the people were burnt beyond recognition, but somehow or other, the insignias all survived. And on some of the uniforms, you could still see the patchwork and stuff. We went and got body bags and sheets to put over people, even if for no other reason than to make us feel better.
Philip Smith, Branch Chief, U.S. Army, Pentagon. One arm is scarred up to about my shirt sleeve, and all of that turns black. While I was at the hospital, they trimmed all the dead skin off. My face was like one big scab.
Lieutenant Colonel Rob Grunewald. It was getting later in the day, and I was becoming sick. I'm coughing up all kinds of black phlegm and stuff. An Air Force Lieutenant Colonel comes up and says, "Come on, let me help you. We'll get you over to the medical tent." They asked, "What hospital do you want to go to?" I go into an ambulance. I'm the only one on the highway. The highways were shut down. The siren was going. I was looking out, and I was the only game in town.
Philip Smith. One of my co-workers, a lady by the name of Martha Carton, was also released. We weren't able to reach anybody by cell phone. All of the communications were down. I walk out of the hospital, and Arlington Hospital is a big hospital. The door that I walk out of, I run into one of my neighbors from a prior assignment, a friend who had driven to Arlington Hospital to come and find me. I literally bump into him at the door. It was Major Rex Harrison. I said, "Rex, what are you doing here?" He said, "Well, I came to pick you up." I said, "Well, that's great. Thank you so much. Can we take Martha home?
Lieutenant Colonel Rob Grunewald. I got a Purple Heart for my injuries, and I got a Soldier's Medal for my actions that day. There were only maybe 11 or 13 people that got both medals. The Soldier's Medal is the highest medal you can get for bravery not in a combat environment. Somebody obviously thought I did something good. Probably Martha.
Louise Rogers. I was at Washington Hospital Center in the intensive care unit. It wasn't until about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon that day that I woke up. I have some vague, nightmarish understanding that something happened. I was so out of it, I don't know what was real and what wasn't real. I remembered hearing my husband's voice for the first time and having the thought, well, I don't have to fight to try to stay awake or be conscious right now. He's here. I can let him take care of everything. And go back to sleep. So that's what I did.
By day's end, the military had rallied an impressive air armada to America's skies. Hundreds of planes flying over most major U.S. cities. Inside the Pentagon, the leaders sorted through the day's toll and what the next day would bring.
Victoria Tory Clark. Senators John Warner and Carl Levin came down to the building in late afternoon. They sat in one of the smaller workstations in the command center, and the secretary took a call from the president and put them on the phone. They were clearly struck by what had happened and came down simply to show their support. They went out with the secretary to tour the site in the late afternoon.
Lawrence DeRita, Special Assistant to Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. One of the things that stood out in my mind is the regularity that we got back to so quickly. How quickly we were able to snap back into place and get back to work. The secretary was very clear that he wanted people back to work the next day.
Colonel Matthew Klimo. At 1725 hours, 525, Secretary Rumsfeld said, "I want the chain of command to notify everybody that tomorrow, 12 September, is a normal work day at the Pentagon. I want everybody here reporting for work," which was, at the time, a pretty startling announcement.
Donald Rumsfeld. I hadn't talked to anybody when I said that. It was more attitude. My impression was that the smoke and problems had declined, and that there were undoubtedly significant portions of the building that could be occupied safely, and so I decided. I thought it would be a good thing for the Pentagon not to be shut down.
Admiral Edmund Jim Bastiani. We thought of having a press conference here in the building. We wanted to send the right message to the rest of the country and do a press conference in this building that night. At 6 p.m., we did it, even though it was still smoky in the passageways.
Victoria Tory Clark. The building was still filled with smoke, and quite a few people thought the briefing should be held off-site. I was not the only one, but I was probably the most vocal advocate for briefing here in the building. We had to show that the building was up and operating, and it was important for people to see their Secretary of Defense and the leadership here. We also decided it was a good idea to have Senator Warner and Chairman Levin with them.
Admiral Edmund Jim Bastiani. The secretary was magnificent. Carl Levin and John Warner came over to show support. They were up on the podium with him. I think that set the tone for America that first evening.
I'd never heard of Al-Qaeda before. Airborne, en route to Andrews Air Force Base. Air Force One left off at Air Force Base at 4:36 p.m. Eastern Time, en route to Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington, D.C. The president, finally, was coming home.
Colonel Mark Tillman, Presidential Pilot, Air Force One. I'm doing about 0.94 Mach. We went as fast as we could across the United States. F-16s were coming out of Washington, D.C. to meet us. Everybody was joining up with us. We had F-15s with us as well.
Mike Morrell. On the flight to Andrews, I finally got this packet full of all the intelligence the CIA had. It included the talking points that George Tenet had used to brief the president, but there was still a lot he hadn't been able to say. I shared all those details with the president. The second half of the packet was a set of intelligence passed to us by a European ally, explaining that it had detected signs that Al-Qaeda was planning a second wave. When I was showing that to the president, I could tell from his reaction it struck him. Gosh, this could happen again. This isn't over.
Eric Draper, I asked Andy Card at one point, who did this? Al-Qaeda. I'd never heard of Al-Qaeda before.
Andy Card, Chief of Staff, White House. By the time we're coming from Stratcom, it was a skeleton crew aboard. The closer we got to Washington, the more the president wandered.
Brian Montgomery, Director of Advance, White House. I found the president at the front of the staff cabin at one point. I said, we're going to hit him hard, right? When this is all over? He said, yes. Yes, we are. I knew that look in his eyes. He was mad.
Ellen Eckert. The president came back to the press cabin. I asked him if he was doing okay, and he said yes. I asked, have you spoken to Mrs. Bush? He said, yes, she's fine. He patted me on the back twice. Then Doug Mills, the AP photographer, said, keep your spirits up. The president said, we won't let a thug bring this country down.
Sonia Ross. I was typing away in the press cabin, working on my notes when the president came in, and I don't think he saw me at first. I started typing that quote down, and he heard me typing and turned to me, hey, off the record. He didn't say anything else.
Ellen Eckert. He gave Sonia the stink eye.
Gordon Jandro. He was trying to be a very calm and comforting presence to everyone.
Eric Draper. Everyone was trying to take it all in. I took this picture of Cindy Wright, a White House nurse, rubbing the president's back. At another moment, the president had his arm around Harriet Myers as they walked down the plane.
Captain Cindy Wright, nurse, White House Medical Unit. What's funny about that picture is I don't really remember being compassionate or ministering to him. I do remember that he came in to check on me and the team. It was amazing to me that he was walking through the plane, checking on us. It was still fairly new in the administration, so we knew each other from talking and being at the ranch, but that was the first time we hugged. I'm a big hugger, and he is too.
Ann Compton, reporter, ABC News. We were finally able to say on the record, I called my bureau and told them, that the president was heading back to Washington and would address the nation from the Oval Office.
Colonel Dr. Richard Tubb, presidential physician. The thing at that moment I was most worried about was a biologic attack. In the unlikely but high-risk scenario, I thought there was little harm to be prophylaxing the staff with antibiotics. I gave everyone on the plane a week of Cipro. I hoped by the time they ran out, we'd have figured out the fog of war and know whether we needed to continue measures.
Brian Montgomery. I noticed that Dr. Tubb was walking and talking to each person. He'd lean over and whisper to each person, pat them on the shoulder, and he'd hand over a little envelope, like what the military uses to put pills in. He got to me and said, Monty, that was my nickname. How do you feel? I said, other than the obvious, physically, I feel fine. You don't feel disoriented? Nope. Then he said, have you ever heard of Cipro? We don't know what might have been in that school, so we're being careful. I asked him, what's it used for? He told me, in case it's anthrax.
Mike Morrell. It was about an hour from touching down, pretty late in the day. A lot of people were asleep, and the lights on Air Force One were turned down. The president came back into the staff compartment. I was the only one awake. One of the things that struck me, he transformed right before my eyes from a president who was struggling a bit with the direction of his administration on September 10th to a wartime president, just in a matter of hours. I could already see this new confidence and power in him.
Gordon Jandro. I don't really remember eating, but the stewards put out some sandwiches and chips. The Air Force bills you for your meals aboard Air Force One through the White House military office. I remember a couple days later getting a bill for $9.18. The bill said, for meals on September 11th between Sarasota, Barksdale, Barksdale, Offutt, Offutt, Washington.
Mike Morrell. The president's mill aide, Tom Gould, was looking out the window on the left side of the plane. He motioned me over. Look, there was a fighter jet on the wingtip. In the distance, you could see the still-burning Pentagon. Throughout the day, all this is happening and you don't really have the chance to feel the emotion. But that got me. Tears filled my eyes for the first time that day.
Andy Card. We kneeled on the benches to look outside. You could see the fighter jets coming up pretty close to Air Force One. You just don't see that on Air Force One.
Carl Rove. I realized this was no ceremonial escort. This was the last line of defense in case there was a manpad, surface-to-air missile, on the approach to Washington. They were going to put themselves between Air Force One and whatever the threat was.
Colonel Dr. Richard Tubb. As we were coming in on final approach, Dan Bartlett came into my office and said, "Thanks, I took all those pills. Anything else I need?" I said, "What? Absolutely not. That was supposed to be a week's worth." I'm flipping through the physician's desk reference, that huge book, trying to figure out what the toxic level of Cipro is.
Brian Montgomery. Dan was real worried for a moment. After all that happened that day, Dan was going to die from Cipro poisoning.
Colonel Dr. Richard Tubb. I looked into it and told him, "Listen, you're going to be fine. You might want to take an antacid."
Colonel Mark Tillman. As we were landing, I was thinking all I have to do is get him on the ground and then I can hand him off to the Marines. I was watching the fighters scream by underneath us doing suppression for us. I was trying to figure out if there was anything waiting for us on the ground. The landing itself, after everything, was entirely normal.
Major Scott Hooter Krog. We had landed right behind Air Force One, and so we saluted as the President's helicopter and Marine One took off. We knew the President was heading to the White House.
Ari Fleischer, Press Secretary, White House. There are several different routes that Marine One can take back. We took the most scenic, directly over the Capitol, down the Mall, at the Washington Monument, you bank right.
Andy Card. We only flew at treetop level, zigzagging to make it harder for a missile to hit us. We were really low to the water on the Potomac.
Ari Fleischer. Out of the front left of the chopper, the president had a clear view of the Pentagon. The president said to nobody and everybody, "The mightiest building in the world is on fire. This is the face of war in the 21st century."
A spontaneous song. Evening in Washington. With the president en route to Washington, scheduled to arrive around 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the congressional leadership hidden at Mount Weather began to make their way back as well. In the early fall darkness, about 150 representatives and senators gathered at the Capitol around 7:45 p.m.
John Feary, press secretary to Speaker Dennis Hastert. We took a helicopter ride back from the secure location. Beautiful Virginia sunset, beautiful day, and seeing the flames still leaping up from the Pentagon. It was really quite a sight and quite emotional.
Senator Tom Daschle. Yet with that soft September light was chaos all around. Smoke still billowing from the Pentagon, fire trucks below, jets above, tanks and all kinds of security. Just an amazing transformation of what started as one of the most tranquil and beautiful days of the year that morning.
Brian Gunderson. You knew something was very wrong with the world that day. We passed over some office buildings in Northern Virginia that had dump trucks parked at the entrance to their parking lots to prevent possible car bomb attacks.
Steve Elmendorf. It was very surreal to fly in helicopters, see the smoke coming out of the Pentagon, land on the Capitol grounds with a heightened level of security. At that time, it was very rare to see the Capitol Police with a machine gun or a shotgun or anything remotely like that. We landed and there were all sorts of people with automatic weapons and SWAT gear surrounding us, surrounding the helicopters.
John Feary. It had really become a fortress.
Representative Martin Frost. At some point, there was a report on television that members were going to come back and meet at a certain time. So I did, along with everybody else.
Representative Dennis Hastert. We walked across the east front of the Capitol, and there were probably 200, maybe 175 or 225 members of Congress on the front stairs of the Capitol. Wow, it's pretty amazing. Members of the House, members of the Senate, Democrats, Republicans.
Senator Tom Daschle, I don't recall seeing a smile the entire evening. It was facial expressions that were somber, very, very grave.
Eve Butler G. By then, of course, we had learned about Flight 93. It was very bittersweet because our sense was that that plane was headed for the Capitol building. Had it not been for those people, it could have been much, much worse. They gave their lives to save ours.
Representative Dennis Hastert. Daschle came up and spoke for a couple 20 seconds or so. I got up and basically said, look, this country will be okay. We're going to stand up. We'll be back to work tomorrow. We'll do the people's work and get this country going again. And we'll find out who did this and protect our country.
Senator Tom Daschle, after the two speeches, there was a moment of silence that wasn't scheduled. Nobody really wanted to leave. People started holding hands. Somebody started to sing.
Representative Dennis Hastert. As I turned back to go back to the place I was standing, somebody broke out in the crowd of members of Congress in God Bless America.
John Feary. I think it was Representative Jennifer Blackburn Dunn who started breaking out in God Bless America.
Senator Tom Daschle. It didn't take long before everybody began singing along. It was probably the most beautiful part of the entire experience, totally unplanned, totally spontaneous, but probably more powerful than whatever the speaker and I said.
Representative Dennis Hastert. I remember the chills going down my spine. I remember thinking, this country will be okay. We'll stand shoulder to shoulder.
Eve Butler G. I cried. That was the moment when I really lost it, watching that happen. The feeling was, no matter what happens, nobody's going to defeat us, either psychologically or in actual fact.
Celine Haga, staff, U.S. House of Representatives. In the hours and days and weeks later, when it was replayed on TV, it felt trite and corny. But in that moment, that night, it felt like we were clinging to something, like a lifeline.
Representative Martin Frost. Then, we dispersed.
Marine One arrived at the White House shortly after 7 p.m., landing on the South Lawn.
Alberto Gonzalez, White House Counsel. The rest of the afternoon, I just ran between the underground bunker, the Situation Room, and my office on the second floor of the West Wing, making sure that all the legal issues were being evaluated as policymakers were making decisions. Finally, at about 7:30, I stood outside the Oval Office with Karen Hughes, the communications director, and we watched as Marine One landed on the South Lawn. We greeted the president as he returned home. We followed him into the Oval Office and then back into his private dining room. There, with Ari Fleischer, the press secretary, Andy Card, the chief of staff, Condi Rice, the national security advisor, Karen and I and the president, we talked about what happened that morning. We talked about what we were going to do in response to the attacks, and we talked about what the president was going to say in his address to the nation that night.
Nick Callio. I stuck my head in at one point and said, how are you doing, sir? The president said, I'm ready and you need to be ready too. He was calm, the look in his eye was intense, and then when he talked to the senior staff, he said, we all have to be ready. We are at war. We have to let the American people know that we're going to protect them. In a month from now, we're all going to want to go back to baseball and football and not think about this. But it's going to be our job to make sure that we're always thinking about it.
Condoleezza Rice. By that night, the president was in the mood to start handing out assignments. He really was determined that Don Rumsfeld was going to be doing his work to make sure the military was ready.
Commander Anthony Barnes. Karen Hughes banged out that statement on her knees because there weren't any other chairs in there next to a computer. She kneeled down beside a computer and banged out that statement in about 20 minutes. When the president got back, he edited it for a couple of minutes, and then it was to the Oval Office for the television cameras.
Josh Bolton, Deputy Chief of Staff, White House. I was nervous for the president because I knew how important this was to the feeling in America that day.
We go forward to defend freedom. In the Oval Office. 8:30 p.m.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts. The victims were in airplanes or in their offices, secretaries, businessmen and women, military and federal workers, moms and dads, friends and neighbors. Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror. The pictures of airplanes flying into buildings, fires burning, huge structures collapsing, have filled us with disbelief, terrible sadness, and a quiet, unyielding anger. These acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation into chaos and retreat. But they have failed. Our country is strong. A great people has been moved to defend a great nation. Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America. These acts shatter steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve. America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world, and no one will keep that light from shining. Today, our nation saw evil, the very worst of human nature, and we responded with the best of America, with the daring of our rescue workers, with the caring for strangers and neighbors who came to give blood and help in any way they could. Immediately following the first attack, I implemented our government's emergency response plans. Our military is powerful, and it's prepared. Our emergency teams are working in New York City and Washington, D.C. to help with local rescue efforts. Our first priority is to get help to those who have been injured and to take every precaution to protect our citizens at home and around the world from further attacks. The functions of our government continue without interruption. Federal agencies in Washington, which had to be evacuated today, are reopening for essential personnel tonight and will be open for business tomorrow. Our financial institutions remain strong, and the American economy will be open for business as well. The search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts. I've directed the full resources of our intelligence and law enforcement communities to find those responsible and to bring them to justice. We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them. I appreciate so very much the members of Congress who have joined me in strongly condemning these attacks. And on behalf of the American people, I thank the many world leaders who have called to offer their condolences and assistance. America and our friends and allies join with all those who want peace and security in the world. And we stand together to win the war against terrorism. Tonight, I ask for your prayers for all those who grieve, for the children whose worlds have been shattered, for all whose sense of safety and security has been threatened. And I pray they will be comforted by a power greater than any of us, spoken through the ages in Psalm 23. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. This is a day when all Americans from every walk of life unite in our resolve for justice and peace. America has stood down enemies before, and we will do so this time. None of us will ever forget this day, yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world. Thank you. Good night. And God bless America.
After the president's Oval Office address, Vice President Cheney boarded a helicopter to fly to an undisclosed location for the night, a site that later would be revealed as Camp David. Cheney slept that night in the president's own cabin, known as Aspen, a violation of normal protocol made necessary because Aspen connected directly to the presidential retreat's own escape bunker.
Dick Cheney, as we lifted off and headed up the Potomac, you could look out and see the Pentagon, see that black hole where it'd been hit. A lot of lights on the building, smoke rising from the Pentagon. It helped bring home the impact of what had happened, that we had, in fact, been attacked.
Louis Scooter Libby, Chief of Staff to Vice President Dick Cheney. I recall watching the Vice President, who was staring out the window at the Pentagon, and wondering what he may be thinking about, the responsibilities he would have in the future. A pretty sobering moment.
David Addington, counsel to the Vice President. The headquarters of the U.S. military was still smoking, and we were flying over on our way to hide the Vice President. My God, we're evacuating the Vice President from Washington, D.C. because we've been attacked.
Dick Cheney, I remember sitting in the living room there in the Aspen cabin, turning on the television, watching the reruns. I suppose that was the moment, as much as any, that it really hit home what the country had been through that day.
I spent the evening just crying. The evening of 9/11. Families across the country struggled to understand what the attacks meant for their loved ones, while those directly affected continued to scatter and make their way home, sometimes without knowing how their own families had been affected.
Charles Kristoff, attorney, Broadway. I tried to reach Penn Station, and from Penn Station eventually to get the train to go to Maplewood, New Jersey. Everything was closed. We had to wait hours. I think late afternoon, finally, they let the first train go. I was not able to catch the first one, but I did get the second one. People were looking at me because I was totally covered with dust in my hair, my suit, everything. Bruno Dellinger, Principal, Quintamassis, North America, North Tower. When I arrived home, on my apartment door, there was a post-it from one of my interns who left a funny note. If you're alive, I'm still alive.
Rosemary Dillard, Washington, D.C., base manager, American Airlines, and wife of Flight 77 passenger Eddie Dillard. I had to drive by the Pentagon. I wanted to stop. They wouldn't let you. I got home, went in the house, and I smoked 4 cigarettes. I figured if I smoked in the house, it would bring my husband back because he didn't smoke in the house. Then I had to call his brothers. I had to call my friends, the rest of his family, and my sister. My neighbors started coming over right away because the flight attendants lived in the area. They came and brought me dinner. After that, it's kind of a blur. Life changed.
Linda Crooner. I didn't really know what happened yet. I certainly knew we lost people. When I was at my sister's house in New York City, there was a fellow, he got my number, he knew I was in the building that morning, and he said, "I'm so-and-so, did you see my son? Did you pass him on the staircase?" This young fellow died. It was terrible. It was really one of these calls that you want to say, "I wish I saw him. I wish I could tell you something." I couldn't tell him anything.
Adrian Pierce. Kathleen, she sat behind me. We don't know where she was. Carlos, we don't know where he was in the building. Toyina, she got killed also. Jeffrey got killed. Antoinette was holding a guy. His name was Tom. She was holding his hand as we were coming out of the building, and he let her hand go and the building came down on her. We lost 5 people from Wachovia. I also lost 150 friends from Eurobrokers on the 88th floor. One friend in particular, Adam, he came out, he called his parents, and he said, "I'm okay." but he went back in the building, and he never came back out.
Charles Kristoff, I was worrying about my wife, Kirsten, a vice president of risk services at Aon Corporation on the 104th floor of the South Tower. I was worrying about our daughter, Gretchen, because we didn't have close relatives to pick her up from the daycare. I was hoping maybe Kirsten was able to get on the first train or on this train, and I will meet her there or meet her at home.
Robert Small. I was home before I normally would have been home. I still thought we were supposed to have our Pop Warner football team pictures taken that night. I still thought we were going to do that. I got a phone call from the league guy. We're not taking pictures tonight. I said, okay, because it still hadn't hit me how dramatic and big the day was. It was still my day, as opposed to what it meant to everybody else. Within the next day or two, you started realizing how many people it affected.
Dina Burnett. I spent the evening just crying and being with friends, having neighbors come in and out, and having family call me on my cell phone to offer their condolences. Rosemary Dillard. I was still calling his cell phone, and he had a pager. I was still paging it every so often.
Charles Kristoff. I got to Maplewood. We usually parked our car by the train station, but I didn't have a key, so I had to walk to the daycare. I took my daughter from the daycare, and I asked about my wife. Only my daughter was there. All the other kids were taken by their parents, and one or two people from the staff. She was a baby, 11 months old, and she didn't understand. She recognized my face and obviously was happy to see me. One of the employees of the daycare drove me to my home. I didn't have a key. I had to break the window on the back door in the kitchen to enter. I immediately took care of my daughter. I had to feed her and change her and put her in the bath because it was already 6-7 o'clock. And then I was just sitting by the phone waiting for a call.
Jillian Volk. We spent the whole night going from hospital to hospital, checking the admittance lists. Then at 7 o'clock that night, we got a phone call from Bellevue Hospital saying my fiancé Kevin was admitted there. His dad got there before we did, and he found out it wasn't the right Kevin Williams, it was somebody else. We had been on this whole high, screaming. I searched the city for 3 days.
John Napolitano. It was late, and the kids wouldn't go to sleep because my son, whenever he worked nights, he would always call and talk to them and tell them a story over the phone. And then he would end with hugs and kisses, and they'd go to bed. They weren't going to bed because their father didn't call.
Charles Kristoff. I was waiting for Kirsten's call, but nobody called.
Fernando Ferrer. I organized a prayer vigil on the Grand Concourse at Love Gospel Assembly. What else could you do? That place was packed. We then made the rounds of firehouses. We saw guys come back covered in white dust. People had already set up. Oh, I get emotional just talking about it. Had set up shrines and brought flowers and stuff and lit candles. It was really something.
Perry Whedon, Los Angeles. I had been dating someone for 6 months and was unsure where the relationship was heading. This normally very calm and collected man was anxious and shaken, distraught over the lives already lost and fearful that LA was in the crosshairs. We went to Santa Monica Pier, a relative ghost town, for a warm September day, an attempt to be defiant in the face of fear. He made a comment I would never forget, something about how if the world was going to end today, he was glad to have spent it with me.
Richard Colco, Special Agent, FBI. I started the day in the Atlanta FBI field office assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. By midday, I was driving to Washington, D.C. A New York agent who was stuck in Atlanta jumped in the car with me. The roads were deserted. It was nighttime. We were